My name is Michael McCusker. I'd like to read something that another old friend of mine wrote about the event 2 days ago in 1969. Moonshot by Arthur Honeyman. And he wrote this, it's a poem, on July 21st, 1969, the day after. Moonshot. Yesterday went beyond history, and I watched it while my mind couldn't fathom or accept or believe what my eyes saw. Everything seemed, looked, like a stage, a science fiction stage, as the camera swung round and vistaed the miles of barren flat lands and the hills peaking in the distance and transmitted each image 240,000 miles to my eye receptors. Then came the spacesuits with voices from inside. Men they were supposed to be, men that I couldn't grasp or see, bouncing, floating like a robot, but really, they say, it was 1/6 gravity. Yesterday's events, my left-wing friends will say, were a waste of money, for a man is too small to take care of Earth, never mind littering or garbaging or cluttering the rest of the universe, or even a piece of it. Much as they may be right, I'm all for space travel. But already I see man carrying his ego beyond the world. Yesterday he drove his prejudicial American flag into the soil, claiming peace and territory at the same time. Already he carries his colonial ambitions beyond the Earth's atmosphere in the spirit of Columbus or Admiral Byrd or modern-day presidents, claiming for the United States its democratic, imperialistic idiosyncrasies. I'm all for space travel. I think it could be the salvation of man. Our world of overpopulation may force us to move on or destroy ourselves. But I pray to some God with some vague hope that there is such a God, that yesterday's primitive performance of erecting American flags or Russian flags or Andorran flags symbolizing possession is never repeated again. But knowing man, knowing the U.S., it will be, and man will garbage the universe. Yesterday went beyond history, but man stayed primitive man. Yesterday, I don't believe what I saw, that man stood and walked on the moon, that he stood there and borrowed, probably forever, from the once awesome, silent sea of tranquility. And that was by Arthur Honeyman, and he wrote that the following day, July 21st, 1969. And in the same sense, another star explorer has died. And the New York Times had it in its Sunday edition by Lawrence Downs, and they called it simply Starman. And this man was also an explorer. Mao Pilung will never be as famous as Captain James Cook, a master of the classic European feat of discovering places with people already in them. But Pilung, who died last week at the age of 78, could have matched Cook's voyaging island for island across the vast immensity of the Pacific, and without charts, compass, or sextant. He was a Palu, a master navigator, one of the last experts in the ancient art of Pacific Ocean wayfaring. Crossing an open ocean without instruments in knife-edged canoes, as the Polynesians did 1,000 years before Cook, is one of the great achievements in human exploration. To those of us who are blind to the night sky and deaf to the language of clouds, currents, and ocean swells, it seems like a mystical or superhuman act. It is not. The Palu's skill is an achievement of reason, memory, and calculation, though a staggering one. Mr. Pilung, a native of the Caroline Islands, began his training as boy, studying chunks of coral on a woven mat. Over decades, he learned an age-old map of his Micronesian universe. On it were etched hundreds of star names, the habits of fish and birds, landmarks and routes through reefs and shoals. He earned wide renown in 1976 when he led a daring 6,000-mile voyage from Hawaii to Tahiti and back in a double-hulled canoe. The double-hulled canoe, which is called Hokulia, did not resolve the question of whether the first prehistoric voyages to Hawaii had been accidental or intentional, but it did show that long-distance navigation was still possible. The voyage was a watershed moment for Hawaii, whose people had been slowly pulling their trampled folkways back into existence, the way fishermen in Pacific mythology were thought to have pulled whole islands from the depths. In Hawaii, until Mao Pialug shared his knowledge, the Palu's art had been lost for a millennium. His Hawaiian student, Nainoa Thompson, became a navigator in his own right, and many voyages have followed thanks to an extraordinary act of cross-cultural generosity. And that was Starman, Lawrence Downs, and in honor of Mao Pialug, great world navigator, who died last week. Well, I'd like to return to Arthur Honeyman, whom, as I think many of you know, died a couple of years ago, almost 2 years ago, in December 2008, December 8th, as a matter of fact, anniversary of the Great Astoria Fire of 1922. Arthur was 68. He was born 70 years ago on May 10th, 1940. And he wrote many things, aside from just the trials and tribulations and sturdiness of handicapped people, which is a term he himself didn't particularly care for. And he had cerebral palsy. I'd like to read in honor of yesterday's signing of the watered-down bank bill that Obama signed yesterday, or day before yesterday, The Business of America by Arthur Honeyman. And Honeyman looks, he wrote this some time ago, and he looks at all that has happened to the American economic system as Reaganomics. So that's why you will see it mentioned or hear it mentioned. I am as guilty as anyone for not expressing my deep down concerns about the extensive and catastrophic dangers of Reaganomics, dangers which I believe amount to de facto treason against the citizenry of the United States. This betrayal may or may not have been a conscious effort of conservative members of American society to reduce the numbers of classes from several, which constitute an ability for citizens to easily move from one economic status to another, to only two, which constitute the very rich and therefore powerful minority and the very poor and powerless majority. The ultimate goal of conservatives is to return the United States to 18th century laissez-faire principles. From what I understand as an individual whose knowledge of economics is minimal, this mercantile hands-off policy not only glorifies the free enterprise system, but also allows the top dog to squelch all opposition by whatever means it takes to remain on top. Under such conditions, there is no place within the status quo for regulations that promote and legitimize economic mobility between classes. Conservatives are correct when they claim it is liberals who are primarily responsible for regulation in this country. Right from its founding, the United States government has been mandated to establish laws to protect the interests of its citizenry. As stated in that famous historical document held so dear to Americans, the Declaration of Independence, we have indicated that we fully expect certain rights to be legally enforced in order to ensure an opportunity to pursue a variety of avenues to success without fear of being trampled upon by top dog plutocrats. Although Theodore Roosevelt for example, was an expansionist of American territory. It was he who recognized the need to curb gigantic conglomerates through regulation in order to prevent corporate monopolies from swallowing smaller business entities. Famous is the statement of Calvin Coolidge when he claimed that the business of America is business. Then the Great Depression hit. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Theodore's cousin, who could plainly see that the business of America is people. Immediately, he took steps to ensure that Americans would get back on their feet. His famous promise of a New Deal for Americans is indicative of the direction in which he was headed. It was toward economic regulation in several areas. Possibly there are those who will claim that it was World War II that wrought our economic recovery, not Roosevelt's economic regulations or work programs. The war may have been a temporary stimulus to the economy, though I contend that war is always a drain on resources and human power. But history indicates we were recovering anyway. The point, however, is that perhaps for the first time in history, a government realized the value in subsidizing its populace in order to step up its economy. It takes possession of currency to establish a flow of currency and therefore a fluid economy. The greater the cash flow, the more mobile a society is. By the same token, the more mobile a society is, the greater the opportunity for individuals to move up the social and economic ladders, which results in the de facto decrease of differences between classes, a condition considered anathema by most conservatives. But Roosevelt, FDR, did more than upgrade the economic standard of living for Americans. He also initiated the process that enabled the average citizen to receive a college education. This brilliant and ethically far-sighted move was loudly protested by conservatives who hastened to assert it was an unnecessary waste of time and resources. Unnecessary because this was America, and in America, you did not need a college education to be financially successful, and if wealthy, you could afford to pay for it yourself. On the surface, this line of reasoning seemed okay. But Roosevelt recognized that an ever-increasing technology required a formal knowledge not adequately available without higher education. It is clear to me that educated conservatives recognize the role knowledge intrinsically plays in a mobile society, and especially as a tool to enable individuals to achieve some of their dreams. If this assessment is indeed correct, then it is clear they must also understand the role the lack of formal education plays in keeping a society stagnant and in keeping most individuals safely locked into the classes they were born into. And of course, they understand what Roosevelt understood, that it costs money to go to college. Although Roosevelt was not directly responsible for creating most of the programs instituted by his liberal successors, he established the climate in which they operated. Historians for the more than half century since his death have implied that the man was simply a shrewd and ambitious politician who surrounded himself with advisors who were the creme de creme of liberal American intellectual thought. Whereas this observation may be true, I nonetheless believe he had an altruistic and enlightened side, more often than not inspired by his indomitable wife, Eleanor, which gave him an interesting sense of both compassion and noblesse oblige. He left a legacy. After the Roosevelt-Truman administrations came the middle of the Rhode Eisenhower years, during which the only noteworthy act of the president was the seemingly enigmatic but haunting warning to beware of the military-industrial complex, a warning that is now verified by the echoes of time. After those long, slow, know-nothing years came the active voice of the golden boy of Cape Cod, John F. Kennedy, who found himself backed into a corner of making decisions in behalf of equal rights and opportunities for all Americans. Those were the turbulent 60s, and Jack could not win no matter how successful he was. His good deeds were soaked in blood as he was shot through the head while he was in office. JFK put in his bid for prosperity for all Americans. He did his best for higher education, the fine arts, and the Peace Corps, his own creation. But it was Kennedy's successor, the man who survived him, Lyndon B. Johnson, who actually declared war on poverty. Not only did Johnson continue with his illustrious predecessor's maneuvers to advance prosperity for all of this nation's citizenry, he also advanced some designs of his own. If I recall correctly, it was largely due to LBJ's persuasive efforts that not only enabled the federal government to support Martin Luther King Jr. in his civil rights activities, but to help create a well-oiled political machine and federal bureaucracy for the express purpose of dispensing funds in accordance with regulations largely established during his term of office, to alleviate pockets of extreme poverty and to assist disadvantaged members of American society to receive proper training or education so they might pursue avocations of their choice. For example, the Johnson administration was largely responsible for strengthening the affirmative action programs by means of establishing the funds, as well as the administrative rules needed to implement and sustain the program on a realistic basis. In doing so, his administration paved the way for me personally, I have cerebral palsy, to attend graduate school and for thousands of other severely handicapped persons to receive university educations. Fortunately, the Republican administrations of Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford were too busy opening up the Republic of China, trying to hide the Watergate scandal, disclaiming defeat in Vietnam, and otherwise maintaining the status quo, to be actively concerned about liberal congressional activities. Oddly, those were the days when more federal laws were enacted in behalf of handicapped rights than at any other time in history. When Jimmy Carter became president, his administration provided Congress with the support that resulted in the funding of those programs. Thus, for almost 50 years, from 1933 to 1980, increasing numbers of laws were passed in behalf of common folk in this country. But this benevolent and enlightened phenomenon came to a screeching halt in 1979, when middle Americans called for an end of the welfare state, a cause which wrought the Reagan Revolution. And that's in quotes, and also he has in parentheses with a question mark, devolution. Ronald Reagan and his followers succeeded in bamboozling the American people into believing that balancing the budget is more important than the welfare of minorities. Reagan convinced us that balancing the budget, reducing inflation, reducing the national deficit, which his administration raised to an unparalleled level, just as the Republicans are screaming about and have done there. They raised it to a level even beyond Reagan, and now they're the ones screaming for balancing the budget. Pardon me for interrupting it. Reagan convinced us that balancing the budget, reducing inflation, reducing the national deficit, which his administration raised to an unparalleled level, and increasing military defense, which raised the deficit, would reestablish the United States as the world's leading military and economic power and put us back on the road to prosperity. This was at a time unemployment was on record as an all-time high since the Depression of the 1930s, and the value of the American dollar was comparatively low. The appearance of ever-increasing numbers of homeless persons and families were a distinct indication of the plight Reaganomics created for American society. Was this a sign of a nation that cared for its citizens? Or was it a sign of a government that wished to turn the clock back to the days of Coolidge and Herbert Hoover, when the responsibility of the presidency was merely to administrate policy generally made by the wealthy sector of America? Reducing the responsibility of government also reduces the services rendered by government to the people. Reaganomics shifted the burden of responsibility concerning the problem of the homeless, as just one example, from the shoulders of the public sector to private charities. This was not in the best interest of either the common folk or the American dream. First, it enabled the wealthy and powerful to accumulate much more wealth and power in a manner so implied by Coolidge's statement about the business of America. Second, and even more important, the administrators of our government and American policy, domestic and foreign, were all too aware that the likelihood of the private sector being able to raise sufficient funds for more than briefly alleviate a small portion of homelessness was minimal at best. Since poverty is restrictive, oppressive is the word for it, and homelessness, clearly one of the most blatantly visible examples of poverty in America, it can be assumed the administration that allowed its continued blight had few qualms about the oppression of this country's citizens. This is even more evident when we recall that before the Reagan Revolution, The condition of being homeless primarily consisted of a relatively small number of derelicts, alcoholics, drug addicts, hobos, and other social dropouts who made certain choices or errors that led to their vagrant lives. During the 1980s, the Reagan era, praised itself most heartily for bringing renewed prosperity to America, while countless families were driven from their homes and jobs and onto the streets, primarily because Reagan had removed many of the resources previously available for financial assistance from the government. After all, such action does favor the banking business. It is consistent with conservative views expressed by Coolidge. As you may recall, however, I started this article expressing the view that Reaganomics was an act akin to treason, and that voters in 1980 and 1984, not to mention 1988 and the 2000s, were somehow bamboozled into believing that balancing the budget and paying for military weaponry was more important than humanity and its well-being, that any endeavor by the world's wealthiest nation to solve the problems of hunger, homelessness, human rights, and equal opportunity constituted a waste of energy and financial resources. No doubt many liberals who might agree with my strong views about Reaganomics would hasten to placate conservatives by saying my term, akin to treason, applied to Reaganomics is far too strong and out of line, but I think not. For over a period of 50 years, Americans regarded their government as a stewardship which assisted them in times of need, not merely a body of cold and disinterested lawmakers and enforcers. They believed government had a duty to support their struggles to succeed and attain the American dream, regardless of gender, class, or race. Average citizens have been taught that this is the land of opportunity. I am not fantasizing about a magical kingdom where everything happens easily without hard work, or a land of milk and honey, or a lost city of gold, or other legends or illusions about which conservatives so frequently accuse liberals of indulging in. There have existed few more humane governments than American democracy when it has placed the needs of humanity before economic and nation. It baffles me how it was done, but the Reaganites somehow convinced the American voting public of the economically acquisitive 1980s that the socially conscious 1960s, although they were turbulent when it came to selfless promotion of attitudinal changes in behalf of global understanding, peace at all cost, and international brotherly love, was the me generation. This was the decade when hundreds of thousands of Americans decided that me was not enough, that pursuit of world peace, racial and gender equality, equitable distribution of wealth and banishment of world poverty were necessary and ideal goals instead of the avaricious pursuit of wealth and power. The 1960s were the peace-love-dove generation, and though it can be argued that those flower children, such as myself, may have been primarily young, idealistic, overzealous, radical, and otherwise immature, an argument with which I vehemently disagree, it was during that decade that many individuals made sacrifices of jobs, reputations, and even their lives by defying the status quo and the legal system in order to do the right thing. They walked hundreds of miles in civil rights marches before being hauled off to jail in civil disobedience. They demonstrated their protests against the Vietnam War, and some resisted being drafted into military service. The list of selfless acts during those years is lengthy and adequately belies accusations of Reaganites that the 60s were patently representative of me attitudes. But of course, it was the 60s that showed the Reaganites and conservatives in general what they did not want. In my view, the era clearly verified the fears of many Federalists like Alexander Hamilton, who thought George Washington ought to establish himself as a monarch, John Adams, John Marshall, and others who distrusted the ability of average citizens to make the right decisions for the country. The right decisions I am talking about are to maintain the values of the conservative element of society, to keep wider and more clearly defined gaps between social classes. After all, the lower classes lack tradition, good breeding, and education. Reaganites, who took this fear of common folk with extreme seriousness, managed to hit upon the perfect solution, Reaganomics, pre-Rooseveltian ideals and Keynesian economics. By persuading middle Americans that national security is more important than education and rising above one's circumstances, they effectively reduced to rubble 50 years of progress in enlightened and socially humane policy regarding the well-being of humankind. Thus, the philosophy as well as the inherent pragmatism of the Roosevelt era, specifically developed and nurtured to help uplift and sustain the course of humanity in its endeavors to be a better species of animal, was treated as badly as the communist threat, and that's in quotes, that it was created to allay. A profound fear of capitalism during a depression is that the populace will succumb to the economic equity offered by the ideals of communism. After all, the theory of communism, though seldom the practice, is to establish a classless society, a notion that is anathema to American conservatives and probably even most liberals. Almost half a century of Roosevelt's enlightened and compromising tactics were so successful they became a part of American tradition. An increasingly equitable balance between socialism and capitalism made it possible to endure the economic ravage of depression without losing everything that one spends a lifetime working for. These were the times when the chances of rising above one's circumstances were greater than ever before. Americans came to know that there was an opportunity to become formally educated, even if they were financially impoverished, and they did not have to step on toes to do it. More education generally meant more employment. More employment generally meant more upward mobility. Critics, primarily conservatives, hastened to point out that in many nations where education is not so readily available, those who are fortunate enough to attend institutions of higher learning are more knowledgeable than we are. This might be true, yet those nations have little or no social mobility and are governed along severely restricted class lines regardless of education. Whether or not conservatives sincerely believe the country would be better off if only a few are able to rise through the ranks, or if they are actually corrupt and reactionary power mongers, it is still treason, simply because any way you cut it, they are perpetrating oppression that stifles the majority by removing economic power from its reach. This is what Reaganomics achieves. Balance the national deficit, lower inflation, cut back on taxation of the wealthy. Cut back and eventually cut out all socially redeeming programs and expenditures, military expenditures not included. Do all this, and what do you get? First, you get economic depression. Second, you get de facto fascism coming to the economic rescue. Business entities so large that they easily survive the ravages of depression will reestablish the nation's economic stability. Prosperity and fixed classism will long prevail, with the very wealthy permanently at the top and the homeless permanently at the bottom. Reaganomics will have achieved its ultimate betrayal of the American dream, its purpose of establishing an America for the few and privileged. And that was The Business of America by Arthur Honeyman.